für Lonzo irgendwie würde. He works in the European Center for Medium Range
Weather Forecasting.
Weather forecasting. It's maintained a keen interest in theoretical physics, in foundational physics throughout, and it's great to have you.
Okay, thanks, Susan. Yeah. Well, thank you for coming. I'm here mainly on a visit to University of Toronto. The title's a bit kind of obscure, but I hope it'll become less obscure during the talk. But I thought I'd just start with a few faces and people that sort of have influenced me over the years. I guess at least, well, some of them you'll know very well, obviously. This is Dennis Sharma, who was my PhD supervisor at Oxford in the mid-70s. Dennis is a very kind of pivotal person in relativity in the UK. I mean, he was actually a student of Paul Dirac's. So he has an illustrious supervisor. He's generally credited in getting Roger interested in relativity. Roger was a pure mathematician in Cambridge in the 50s when Dennis was there. And of course, Stephen was also one of Dennis's students. I was at Oxford, I think, in quite an exciting time. The first conference I ever went to was the first Oxford Quantum Gravity Conference in 74, which, you know, people like Abdus Salam and John Wheeler were in kind of full flow during that time. And this was when Stephen announced his evaporating black hole result. This was in the days when he could still talk, actually. Although, you know, with some difficulty. But that was kind of very exciting. And during the intervening, I guess that was about 74, and in the intervening years when I was at Oxford, I kind of sat as a sort of poor, ignorant student, but listening to these kind of debates which started in that time between Roger and Stephen about the whole nature of reversibility and irreversibility in gravitational physics and what the implications of Stephen's result was for, you know, the notion of reversibility of basic laws of physics. So this kind of certainly left an impression on me. I was certainly very motivated and sort of Roger's ideas that quantum gravity had to involve give and take from both relativity theory and quantum mechanics certainly resonated with me at the time. And in a way, it ultimately proved my kind of downfall, because I believed what he said so strongly that I couldn't really reconcile myself to work with standard quantum mechanics. And yet I didn't really have, certainly at the time, any good ideas about what that give and take should be in terms of quantum mechanics and relativity theory. And then sort of slightly with twinges of a kind of social conscience that I should be applying science in more socially relevant areas, I actually pretty much quit that field and moved into climate physics and climate dynamics. And this guy is Ed Lorentz, who's often credited as being the father of chaos theory. He's certainly father of a big sort of chunk of chaos theory, as we'll come to. And he's somebody I actually worked very closely with over the last quarter century or so. Sadly, he died earlier this year. But in some sense, what I want to talk about today will be a bit of an amalgam of all these people and their influence on me. I have to say, you know, I view a kind of an education in theoretical physics, foundational physics, is a bit like a Jesuit education. You can't quite shake it off, even no matter how hard you try. So these sort of questions about the give and take, if you like, that Roger was so eloquent in speaking about in the 70s have kind of nagged me over the years, much as I try to ignore them. They keep sort of nagging at me. So this is a kind of a talk from somebody, I guess, that's very much outside the mainstream of the sort of work that you guys, I'm sure, do. And I'm sure you'll find this a bit, what I'm about to say, fairly idiosyncratic. I hope you'll at least come away with something which may be of interest. I think what I want to talk about is about geometry, motivated by very much the ideas of that geometry has now, general relativity has taught us that geometry provides the basis for understanding gravity. Space-time geometry provides the basis for understanding gravity in classical physics. I want to kind of take that as a springboard to propose, so the idea I want to propose and explore is that certain types of geometry, not now in space-time, but in phase space or state space, may provide the key for understanding the role of gravity in quantum physics. And perhaps even more, provide what I think may be a new perspective, or at least I leave this for you to judge anyway, a new perspective on the foundations of quantum theory, which I think kind of overcomes some of these paradoxes of quantum theory, because what I'm about to propose, these types of geometries I want to propose as being very basic in physics, this is my proposal, in the one sense are very atemporal. They're geometries which don't have any concept of time, if you like, associated with them. They're geometries in state space. But nevertheless, they describe dynamical evolution, which itself is perfectly causal. And I'm going to try and use this idea. This will seem a bit obscure at the moment, but I want to try and use this idea to explore some of the, you know, classical paradoxes of quantum mechanics. So let me just start then, since we're talking about gravity. This is a nice animation of the three-body problem in ordinary Newtonian gravity, illustrating what Poincaré discovered, well, I guess 100 years ago now, that chaos, a system as simple as three self-gravitating bodies can exhibit sensitive dependence to initial conditions, which is one of the characteristics of chaos. So that actually goes back 100 years. What my colleague Lorentz discovered in the early 60s was a kind of a system of chaos which also had sensitive dependence to initial conditions, but which exhibited one of these rather fascinating geometries in phase space, the so-called fractal attractors of these types. I mean, this was his famous three-component equations, which has been found in many other systems, as I'm sure you know. What basically distinguishes this type of system from this one is that these equations are dissipative. And it's that dissipation which leads, for example, if you evolve a small volume in phase space with these equations, it will shrink down to a zero volume. It will shrink down onto this attractor and asymptotically have zero volume. So the dissipation is slowly shrinking phase space volumes down to this asymptotically onto this zero volume attractor. This has a fractal dimension, a fractional dimension, which is less than the three dimensions of phase space. So the difference between this and this is basically this is a Hamiltonian system and this is not. Now, I suppose it's true to say, I mean, I've always found these types of fractal sets extremely kind of beguiling in their mathematical beauty. But I guess it's generally considered that, interesting as they may be, they're not considered relevant to fundamental physics, sort of things that you guys do, probably because of the fact that they are dissipative. And one sort of often thinks of dissipation as just a phenomenological process and not something that's fundamental. However, what I want to try and argue in the next few minutes is sort of give you two reasons why perhaps one should think of them as not so much phenomenological, but maybe as something much more fundamental. The first interesting remark to make is that these geometries are actually non-computable in a certain sort of precise way. One can see that in more explicitly in certain types of rather simpler systems than so using differential equations just based on these things, which are affine transformations. And this particular set of three, oh yeah, and I forgot to say, I mean these, sorry, just come back one second. I mean these, this is an example of what I'm calling an invariant set. So it's a subset of state space. And if you initialized your state on that subset, the dynamics would just keep it there forever. So it's invariant to the dynamics. This is another example of an invariant set, the Sierpinski triangle, and it's invariant under these affine transformations. So again, a point on this on this set will stay on the set forever when mapped by these triangles. The interesting thing about these so-called iterated function systems, which are a bit simpler in a sense than differential equations, is that one can show, and this has been done in this rather nice paper by a chap called Dubay. I think that's how you pronounce his name, but I'm not sure, I've not met him. But that there is a kind of correspondence between these geometries and the whole theory of Turing machines, and in particular, the precise relationship between the invariant sets and the sorts of inputs to Turing machines which will never halt. So, for example, on the left-hand side, the fractal geometry, we have things like these sets of affine transformations. These correspond in theories of computing to the alphabet of symbols that are used, which are then concatenated to form strings. Those strings correspond in the fractal geometry to just the composition of affine transformations put together. And then this invariant set corresponds, as what Dubay showed in a precise way, to the strings which just basically correspond to statements that just don't halt under the Turing machine process. And non-trivial properties of the invariant set correspond to computationally undecidable propositions. And one specific example, which Dubay talked about and showed, there's a very famous undecidable problem in the theory of computation called the post correspondence problem, Post being Emil Post, famous founding father of theory of computation. And that has a precise geometric equivalence to the question about whether the invariant set intersects or not a given line segment. The post correspondence problem, if you don't know it, is you have a selection of dominoes, set of dominoes. So here's an example of four piles of dominoes. And the idea is, can you select from these piles a string, if you like, of these dominoes such that the symbols at the top match precisely the symbols at the bottom? So in this particular case, you can get a match. You take the first, you take a domino from the second pile, there it is. You then take one from the first pile, there it is. You then take one from the third pile, there it is. You then take one from the second pile again. So this is the key, you're allowed to repeat. You've got, in a sense, an infinite stack of these dominoes. And finally, one from the last one. And then you'll see that those symbols, A, B, C, A, match A, B, C, A, the bottom. So that's a match. But in general, there is no algorithm for deciding whether a given set of dominoes at the top has a match. And as I say, that has a geometric interpretation in the language of fractals, which is that does the invariant set of a certain set of affine transformations intersect a given line segment? And again, that's sort of considered to be undecidable. So that's one interesting remark about these types of fractal invariant sets. They have a correspondence with the theory of computation. But the second point I want to discuss is really this issue of the convergence or the reduction of phase space volumes onto the invariant set. In the Lorentz type of attractor, it's due to the dissipation of energy. Is there a correspondence of that in more sort of fundamental physics? And this is where I want to... Oh.
Did you mind just pausing there for a minute? I mean, is that a complete one-to-one correspondence, or is it that the, what you've shown is that an example of one is also can be mapped to the other?
I think in the paper the claim is that it is one-to-one. There is a, but I think yes, the claim in the paper that it is one-to-one. So for every geometric property, you can find a proposition in computation theory, which is not decidable, and vice versa.
So does this mean that if there's a rejoinder to the sort of naive argument that somebody like Seth Boyd makes, that every physical system runs a computation? The rejoinder to that is that there are many physical systems of interest that run undecidable computations. I'm sorry, maybe that's a bit facile, but...
I haven't totally followed. Are there physical systems?
So if I take a physical system represented by a fractal invariant set, so if I have a set of Lorentz maps or something like that,
right,
that is in that set, then the properties of the future evolution of that system, in spite of being a deterministic system,
right,
are formally undecided.
That's right. That's right. And that's something I'm going to, I guess, dwell upon in this talk.
So, I mean, it seems to me it would be shocking if you could give one deterministic physical system whose properties were formally undecidable, but you've given a whole class.
Yes, that's good. I think it's a whole class.
Are sets all Hamiltonian systems?
These are not Hamiltonian systems.
These are not. Right.
Oh, wait. No.
These are dissipated, right?
These are dissipated systems.
I'm wondering if sets are not.
I mean, these sets don't exist in Hamiltonian physics. Can we come on and see?
Okay.
This might become clear. I want to address this question of dissipation because, as I say, you know, when I was at Oxford, this was a hot topic, and I guess it's sort of been a hot topic ever since. And this book, which appeared a few years ago now, sort of encapsulates many of these discussions between Steve and Roger they phrased in the context of this sort of idealized so-called Hawking box where you have just some matter which sits in a big box and the boundary. I guess the box is just to kind of keep the system in some sort of finite region. I presume there's no reason why this couldn't be just a kind of compact spherical cosmology or something like that. But anyway, the argument's usually formulated in terms of imagine a big box which kind of reflects everything which hits it, inside of which is a big mass, and we just sit and wait forever and see what happens. And Roger has used this in all of his sort of popular books to motivate his ideas about gravitationally induced collapse of the wave function. And Stephen, of course, disagrees with it. And it seems to hinge around whether one believes that phase space volumes are shrinking due to black hole processes. So this is from that series of lectures between Roger and Stephen. This is from one of Roger's lectures, and this sort of diagram has appeared in, I think, all of his popular books. So he says, yes, I think that information is lost. This is the phase space of this Hawking box. We consider this region B as the part of the region, a part of phase space which contains black holes. So where the contents of the box have collapsed into one or more black holes. This part of phase space is describing situations when the box contains matter where there are no black holes. So we're kind of looking at the phase space flow of this system. And Roger argues that in this region B, when black holes form and eventually evaporate, there is this loss of information, and that corresponds to convergence of these phase space flow lines. And he then goes on to argue that due to Liouville's theorem, which in the way he describes it is a theorem which requires volumes overall to be conserved, then if there is a convergence of phase space volumes in one part of phase space, there must be divergence elsewhere to somehow maintain volumes. And that is a motivation for his objective reduction mechanism. Stephen, on the other hand, believes there is no there's no convergence of phase space volumes and therefore no need for any divergent process. Now, I want to take a third position on this, which is different from either Roger or Stephen. Liouville's theorem is certainly something that I work with a lot in my own sort of professional work on climate dynamics. And, and in a dissipated system, there is indeed a thing called Liouville's theorem, and it basically describes conservation of probability. So, for example, well, if one had, just imagine, here's a kind of cut through a volume, a little volume in the phase space of the Lorentz model, and here we see that volume sort of is starting to stretch out in one of the directions, and eventually it'll wrap itself around, and eventually, as I was saying, that volume will shrink down to zero volume as it asymptotically maps onto the fractal attractor. Now, suppose, for example, I took a point. Let's call a point in here truth. But I don't. Let's say I don't know exactly where this truth is. It could be actually, suppose truth, the point truth could be anywhere. But this isopleth says, for example, there's a 90% probability that truth lies in that point there, lies in that volume there. It's a 90% probability. Then what the Liouville equation says, that as you map forward in time, there is still a 90% probability that the truth point lies within the volume that you co-moved with the dynamical evolution equations, even though the volumes are shrinking. So Liouville's equation is perfectly valid in a non-Hamiltonian system. And it's a little bit like conservation of mass in ordinary Newtonian fluids. If you have an incompressible fluid, then you know volumes are conserved, volumes of just fluid parcels are conserved. If you have a compressible fluid, then volumes can shrink and grow, but the mass of a volume is itself conserved, even though the volume itself may be shrinking. And similarly here, Liouville's equation is perfectly valid in a non-Hamiltonian system and certainly doesn't require volumes to be conserved. So I take issue then with Roger's assertion that in these types of systems, which are manifestly not Hamiltonian, if one believes that there is this type of phase-space shrinkage going on, then clearly one isn't dealing with a Hamiltonian phase flow. But there is no requirement, as far as I can see from the analogy with dissipated dynamical systems, for Liouville's theorem to demand that there's any conservation of volume. So my sort of third way, to use a slightly Blairist phrase, pardon for that, is to say, to agree with Roger that black hole formation evaporation is essentially an information losing process associated with loss of phase-based volume, but that there's no need from Liouville's theorem for any corresponding gain in phase-based volume. And therefore, if we start with a finite volume, we just watch it. We just let it go and see what happens. And one is basically doing the same as one does it with a dissipative dynamical system. You're going to asymptote to three possibilities, a fixed point, it just sort of zaps to a fixed point in phase space and stays there, completely stationary point. Or maybe you've got a limit cycle where it goes around repeating itself indefinitely. Or, more generally, you have this notion of a fractal invariant set. These are all conceivably possible systems. It's interesting to note that once you're on the invariant set, then there is no further loss of phase-space volume, because there is no volume to lose. So in some asymptotic sense, this picture would agree with Hawking that there is no asymptotic loss of phase-space volumes. One point I want to get over, because it'll be important later, is that there's sort of something non-local going on here, but it's not non-local in any causally problematic way. If you take, for example, well, if you take a dynamical system which is dissipative and it has a fractal, let's go back to Lorentz's thing. Every part of the attractor has a kind of fractal structure to it. I mean, obviously, what I'm showing here is just a schematic, but there's a fractal structure everywhere. But you might say, well, where does that fractal structure come from? You can't localize the fractal structure to any one part of state space. It's come from the whole sort of total dynamics. And there may be parts of the attractor which are dissipating more than other parts. So the dissipation can sort of can manifest itself in a sense in a completely separate part of phase space to where it's actually occurring. And so in a similar sort of sense, if one takes this picture but forgets about the divergence and just says all that's going on is convergence, and if it is the case that the asymptotic behavior of this is a fractal type of invariant set, then in these regions of phase space where there are no black holes, you can still get fractal structure which has arisen, that the very reduction in the dimensionality, the fact that you've gone from a finite volume to zero volume, has occurred because the process is in very different part of phase space. There's sort of a non-locality going on here, but it's not I don't think it's a paradoxically problematic non-locality, because there's no concept of causality in this phase space. It's just saying processes going on over here can leave their mark on the structure of the invariant set over here, which has no dissipative type of... I mean, I'm not talking about dissipation now. I'm talking about convergence of phase space lines due to black hole formation. Again, that'll become relevant later on. Okay. So, what I want to do then is explore an idea, or a hypothesis, I suppose, which says that these invariant sets are actually very important, if not primitive, to physics. So I'm going to propose something which is kind of supposed to get right at the heart of basic physics. And I mean, all I can say is a hypothesis, and I'm going to spend the rest of the lecture exploring it. I tried to kind of motivate why it might be relevant to fundamental physics by talking about the Hawking box insofar as black hole processes might give rise to the sorts of phase-space convergence that is needed to generate a fractal invariant subset of state space. But now the real crunch is what I'm calling the invariant set hypothesis, which is that, yeah, we're imagining that at some sort of deep level, the evolution of the universe can be, in fact, described by locally causal deterministic dynamical systems, all the sort of things we'd like to think might be true but seem to be ruled out by quantum mechanics. But nevertheless, I want to propose this, but I'm going to... The reason this might make sense is because this second condition, which I'm going to just conjecture or impose. So the first point is to say that I'm supposing that this sort of dynamics, you know, this is partly electromagnetism, partly gravity, partly due to other nuclear processes and so on. I don't really know what, I can't describe this D, but I'm supposing it exists. This is a dynamical system. with an invariant subset. But now the key point that might make this sensible is this condition here, which is that I'm going to suppose, for whatever reason, and I'll describe two possible reasons why this might be the case, that the state vector associated with this dynamical system lies precisely on that invariant, fractal invariant subset. I mean the state that describes the evolution of that dynamical system. Let's call it just a state then, without using any motive. The state whose evolution in time is described by this system D, which I'm not specifying. Okay? Does that make sense or not? Akin to a classical state, yeah. Yeah, I've got a slide on that. So again, can I come back to that and see if it answers your question? Just very shortly, I think I covered a slide on that question. The basic idea here is that the notion of physical reality, what I'm going to call physically real states or physically real points in state space, will only be attributable to those points on the invariant set. So if you move off the invariant set, then by hypothesis, these are unreal states. Just as a slight aside, I mean, invariance is a bedrock of physics, so I'm using the kind of, in the sense that this whole notion is based on dynamical invariance and that invariance is a bedrock of physics, I that itself sort of may lead one to think that this is worth exploring at least. Oh yeah, so this is, Raphael, this is, I think, what I wanted to say. There was an interesting debate, which I have to say I wasn't part of, but people passed me by at the time, but in relativity theory, about John Barrow, by the way, I was in the next room to him at Oxford. John Barrow and David Deutsch were both contemporaries of mine at Oxford, and I bumped into John. I haven't seen him for years, but I bumped into him around this time, about 97, and I sort of asked him what he was doing, because I was quite interested in chaos theory for weather and climate predictability. And he was saying, oh yeah, you know, chaos is, people are looking at this in general relativity, but there is a problem about, you know, does it make relativistic sense to talk about chaos, because chaos is usually, well, commonly defined in terms of the so-called Lyapunov exponents of the linearized dynamical operators. And if so, you have a nonlinear system, linearize it, look at its exponentially growing modes, and if there are positive modes, then that's an indication of chaos. But exponential growth in time seems to be a non-relativistic idea, because you could always do some sort of time transformation, which logarithmic time transformation, which would then reduce that exponential instability into something which was, say, linear or whatever. And so the question is there a covariant way of introducing the notion of chaos into general relativity? And this was a quote from a paper by, is it Nick Cornish? Neil, thanks. Again, somebody I don't know, but it kind of resonated with my thinking, because because of this whole idea of invariant sets. And this is a quote from one of his papers. It is clear that the standard measures of chaos, such as Lyapunov exponents, have to be abandoned in general relativity. But the problem is solved by introducing fractal dimensions and symbolic codings, something I'll come on to, as diffeomorphism invariant descriptors of chaos in general relativity. Central to these, both of these methods, is the concept of a chaotic invariant set of orbits. So the idea, Raphael, I think, is that one is just thinking of these invariant sets as geometries. And as long as one describes them using geometric concepts or geometric properties, then one has something which is a which seems to be a relativistic concept, unlike the sort of more classical ways of thinking of chaos in terms of Lyapunov exponents. So it's, that's the sense in which I'm trying to think about this, just as a geometry. Yes, and I'll come on to that shortly. Yeah. In fact, again, this slide off the next makes this point. So I want to take this then as a kind of hypothesis and explore it. So you might ask, well, how could this ever arise in sort of physics? Well, one idea, which you might perhaps start off by thinking, well, maybe kind of God or somebody started the world off on its invariant set. Just sort of, right, there you go, that's the initial time, now let it go. And because it's invariant, then once it's on it, it'll stay on it forever. Okay, well, that's an idea. I think a more useful idea, and this is the sort of heart of what I want to try to get at here, is that this hypothesis is really trying to say that the differential equations whose asymptotic behavior generates this invariant set should not be thought of as the primitive notion, but rather one should think that there is some more primitive idea based on the geometry of the invariant set, which somehow then the differential equations become just local expressions of that geometry. To try to get that idea over, there is, yeah. Yes, phase-space geometry. No, nothing to do with space-time geometry at all. Talking about geometry of these invariant sets in state space or phase space. Well, let me give you one specific idea here, which is, I mean, there's a whole body of work in this area called, it often goes under the phrase topological chaos, of how to characterize these fractal attractors in terms of geometric or topological types of properties. And for example, one of the properties of these fractal attractors is that in some sense, nearby to the fractal attractor, there are a kind of an infinity of periodic, unstable but periodic orbits. So here's the Lorentz attractor, and this is just showing an example of one of the unstable periodic orbits. And there are loads of these periodic orbits of different character. Now, one of the ways which people use to characterize the actual fractal attractor is things like the knottedness of these periodic orbits, which are associated with the fractal attractor. So these are some examples of knots which can be found associated with the Lorentz attractor. So the idea here is that, and you can characterize the Lorentz attractor, you know, you can say, this is what makes it different from the Rössler attractor or you know, some other dynamical system attractor by the knottedness of the sort of associated unstable periodic orbits. So what I really want to, the concept I want to get over here is to think about describing these invariant sets using these types of, say, topological, I mean, homology theory has also been used, homological invariants groups has been used as well. To think of these as the primitive expressions for these invariant sets, and to think then of the differential equations which describe the evolution as somewhat secondary to that. All right. Well, the more general theory seems to be, as I say, in terms of homology.
So you have to have
To be honest, I'm not. Yeah. Well, this is something I'm not. I'm more familiar with the three-dimensional situations than the higher-dimensional ones, but I'm aware that homology groups have been used to characterize the structures of higher-dimensional fractal attractor sets, but I can't really tell you precisely how that works because it's not something I've really looked at. Okay. I want to now sort of step back to the try to make sort of contact with what this may or may not have to do with well, eventually with quantum theory, but let's kind of change gears a bit. Here's Bob, and here's Alice, and well, Bob thinks about crossing the road to greet Alice, but Alice sees the speeding red car and calls out, "Watch out, Bob!" And as a result, Bob decides not to cross the road, and well, we could say just as well Bob didn't cross the road at that precise moment, because if he had, he would have been hit by the speeding red car. So there's a sort of typical counterfactual statement, and the question is that true, false, or neither? I want to analyze this in the context of what I've been talking about. Now, that may seem a bit remote, talking about fractal invariant sets and whether Bob would have been hit by the car or not. But let's imagine... Here's part of a state of the world, the universe, on some invariant set. And we're going to imagine somehow perturbing that state. So, and what we're going to do in perturbing it is just change Bob's momentum in the direction sort of orthogonal to the curb here, which was zero, is zero in the real world, because Alice told him, watch out for the car. But what we're going to do is we're going to imagine a hypothetical world where Bob now has some a crossroad momentum. And the question we're going to ask is that, as a result of that, is it true that Bob would be hit by the red car? Now, I want to answer that question. See, in the context of ordinary classical dynamics, it would be kind of obvious. Here's the car going along at sort of 80 miles an hour or something, and here's Bob, and yes, indeed, he'll be hit. But in the context of this invariant set hypothesis, it's not quite so clear. And the reason it's not clear, I'm going to make use of a kind of... I've already talked about links between geometry and dynamics, and there's another link just with very basic ideas in number theory, which are often used in describing these invariant sets. So a very simple invariant set is the Cantor set. We take the interval between 0 and 1, subtract the middle third, then subtract the middle third from what's left, and continue on and continue on. And that can be shown to be an invariant set of some very, very simple dynamical system. Now, points on the invariant set can be described by base 3 numbers, which have no ones, which have no digit one. So here's an example of a point on the Cantor set. This will carry on for a long time, in fact forever, but with no ones. Here's a kind of what I'm calling a random point on the real line between 0 and 1. That would be what would be called a normal number. It would have, for example, a third of the digits would be zeros, and a third of the digits would be twos, and a third of the digits would be ones, things like that. If we add these two numbers together, then we get a number which will have ones in some of the places. In other words, if we perturb a point on the invariant set with some kind of random number on the real line, we'll end up with a number that's off the invariant set. Now, this idea of using these kind of non-normal numbers is a characteristic of these types of fractal invariant sets. We can just generally think of a point on one fractal invariant set without thinking specifically about the dynamics by a vector or a set, if you like, of non-normal numbers in some base, with missing digits. So in the simple Cantor set, base 3, but with missing digit 1. And a random perturbation by a vector of normal numbers, numbers which have their full kind of complement of digits. And if you take this rather special, exceptional number, because this would be a measure 0, these non-normal numbers have measure 0, a random perturbation would have measure 1, the special number will be kind of upset by adding a random number to it, and therefore that will take you off the invariant set. So the idea is to apply that type of thinking to this counterfactual. So here's Bob, and we've added to Bob a completely dynamically unconstrained perturbation. We're just going to say, I'm going to give him an across road momentum of so many, whatever the units of momentum are, kilograms, meters per second. Keeping all other points or all other components of the state of the world fixed. So the position and momentum of the red car is unchanged. The road is unchanged. Alice is unchanged. All we're changing is the state of Bob's across-road momentum. We're changing one component of the state of the universe, keeping everything else fixed. And by that very sort of basic point I made in the previous slide, that a random perturbation to a rather special point, a special number, will take, that perturbation will take the point off the invariant set. So these sets are measure zero, they're nowhere dense, they have the property of being measure zero, nowhere dense. If you just add a random state space perturbation to them, you take them off the invariant set. So this, by this thinking, then, that sort of a perturbation that I can conceive of, but it's not dynamically meaningful, will be one that will take the state of the universe off the invariant set, and therefore it's just simply neither true nor false to say Bob would have been hit by the red car if he had actually crossed the road at that moment in time. And by a similar sort of argument, it's also neither true nor false with respect to this invariant set hypothesis that if Bob would have measured the spin of a given particle, let's say, up, if his apparatus had been oriented differently to what it actually was. We have here something which I think is sort of reminiscent of the Copenhagen interpretation, which means we're sort of getting a little bit... Oh, yeah.
Say some of it is, but in the Cantor set is disconnected, so how can you have any non-trivial dynamics on it at all? I mean, it might be an invariant set, but once you're on it,
well,
in order to remain in it,
well,
the dynamics has to be trivial, doesn't it?
It's in,
since it was continuous in the...
If I had a it's an invariant set of a difference equation. It's the like the logistic equation.
Oh.
You know, x n plus 1 equals xn times xn minus 2 or so. It's an invariant set of a difference equation. So
it's a discrete time, then it's a kind of discrete.
Well, that would be an invariant set of a discrete system.
I see.
What I'm trying to say here, I think, is some,
in my view, some kind of resonance with the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, because what I'm trying to say here is that with this invariant set hypothesis, it's not meaningful to regard an individual subsystem as having any intrinsic property independent of the invariant set on which the state of the universe as a whole evolves. You know, I can't, if I perturb one part of the system keeping everything else fixed, I take myself off the invariant set. The reason I'm saying that is sort of reminiscent of the Copenhagen interpretation is, well, let's just think about experiments, when we do experiments. We do experiments to try to reveal information about subsystems that we're interested in. But by this hypothesis, these experiments and all the measuring apparatus and stuff that goes with them are necessarily parts of the invariant set. They're parts of the state which, by hypothesis, lies on this invariant set. So, in a way, this invariant set hypothesis, by virtue of the structure of these invariant sets, imply that it's really not meaningful to regard a subsystem as having any intrinsic properties independent of the experiments by which us humans gain empirical information about the subsystem. So as I say, this is reminiscent of the Copenhagen interpretation. So I want to kind of pursue this and get a little bit closer and closer to quantum theory as we go on. So one, you know, issue is this thing about...
state of reality, no valid state. I mean, it may be true that a generic perturbation will take you off this invariant subset, but that doesn't mean that there's not within the invariant subset
any perturbation,
some sort of other state which does have Bob crossing, having a non-zero momentum.
Yeah.
That would cross the rod, or does have the Stern-Gerlach set another way.
We don't know, but that's the problem. Generically, unless that perturbation has been somehow designed, but in a way which we can't compute because these are not computable. With respect to the measure of the Euclidean measure of the state space, the generic perturbation will almost certainly, you know, with probability one, take you off the invariant set.
That's all right, but all you need is at least, you don't need a generic perturbation, you just need a perturbation that would correspond to changing the direction of the Stern-Gerlach.
But we don't know what that is.
They're claiming that there might be none.
There might be none.
So it's a sort of super deterministic or whatever people call it.
Well, yeah, let's again, when we come to that. Yeah, so let's deal with that then. So I am presuming that this dynamics is locally causal. So the question is, does this conflict with quantum theory?
What does it mean also? What does it mean exactly? Is it because you're doing it in the context of gravity now, I think. So is it the statement that there's...
Oh, what is it? What is locally causal?
What is local causal?
I just mean that the dynamics, for example, doesn't support any, you know, if I clap my hands or do anything, the information does not propagate out faster than the speed of light. It supports no modes. The dynamics D supports no modes of excitation which travel faster than the speed of light.
It's a little tricky having dealt with this a little bit because you can't analyze that in terms of perturbations of your data given the setup, right? So you can't consider the counterfactual, if I clap my hands.
Oh yeah. But every time I clap my hands, right. Every time I clap my hands, you know, in the quad in Cambridge or something, I hear the sound reflected back 0.1 of a second later.
Are you assuming that it's a deterministic dynamic?
Yes.
I'm assuming that there's some sort of space-time metric. It just seems to me that won't be... If we just take it as a sort of generalist idea or intention, then I guess it makes sense. But
to actually give it
a precise meaning seems to me... It's going to bring in a lot of apparatus of ordinary general relativity, for example.
Well...
So do you mean to all that?
I'm trying to, you know, address this question of that there may be some underlying realistic locally causal dynamics that can account for quantum theory. So
then it could be like a global hyperbolic differential equation, for example.
Anything that you think is sensible and reasonable, then yes. But, you know, just generally speaking, as I say, that, you know, information certainly wouldn't travel faster than speed, but all the things that, you know, you think are sensible. If you want to make it technical, globally hyperbolic, that's fine with me. But the point I want to make is that, you know, so the question is, how does that conflict with the Bell inequalities and so on? And I'm just quoting here a bit from Bell himself that this conclusion that quantum mechanics is not locally causal, which would seem to conflict with that assumption, depends on this notion that experimental parameters are free variables, could be treated as free variables. Now, I came across this on the archive by Te Hooft, who
who's been looking at this question, who looks at this question, what does it mean to say a variable is free? Or more generally, if we talk about a free will axiom, what does that mean? And I thought this was useful because I can kind of compare it with what the invariant set hypothesis says. So Hooft introduces this notion of what he calls the unconstrained initial state condition, which he says has consequences similar to free will but does not clash with determinism. So the key point is, he says, is that we must demand that our model of nature gives credible scenarios for a universe for any choice of initial conditions. He's addressing this question: suppose you've got a deterministic system, which you're trying to use to describe the world, how would you formulate this notion of free will in that context? And the way he does it is to say that my model should be able to give credible scenarios for any choice of initial conditions. So here's a system where we can perturb the initial conditions in phase space any old way we like. We run our model forwards in time and it gives a kind of credible scenario. So this is clearly not the case with the invariant set hypothesis, because I'm saying generic perturbations take you off the invariant set, and therefore, you know, the subsequent evolution of those off invariant set points are just not states of physical reality. So my system, variables can be freely varied only over the invariant set. And this seems to, because this rules out the possibility of these counterfactual measurements, the invariant set hypothesis prevents D from being constrained by Bell inequalities. Now, just tangential remark, just to make sure it's clear what we're talking about here. I mean, classical theory is not of this form. I mean, classical theory is purely based on deterministic differential or difference equations. These are the primary things. If these equations had invariant sets, like the Lorentz equation, there's no constraint from the differential equations themselves for the points to be constrained to the invariant set. So to Hooft's unrestricted initial condition and the Bell inequalities and so on certainly holds for all deterministic theories based on differential or difference equations. So my invariant set hypothesis is adding something to this kind of classical notion. Now, I just wanted to, perhaps I can, before people ask, I want to just kind of come back to this issue, because people, it is a kind of restriction. It's not exactly super determinism, because I'm allowing, in a sense, freedom to vary over states over the invariant set. But it is a significant restriction to free will. And I want to discuss a couple of kind of what I think are the classical objections to kind of trying to restrict freedom of choice, so to speak. And one is that is an argument which I think John Bell himself used, which was that, you know, we can choose to, say, set our measuring apparatuses by some whimsical choice. We can sort of spin a coin, for example, and, you know, if it lands heads, we'll set it in one sense, and if it lands tails, we set it in another sense. And his argument is, well, if we can do that, then effectively the orientation of the measuring apparatus is a free variable, because whilst the toss of the coin may determine the orientation of the measuring apparatus, the toss of the coin has no significant effect on any other aspect of the evolution of the universe. It's kind of irrelevant for the rest of the universe, as far as the rest of the universe. His argument is the rest of the universe could go on just as well if the coin ended up heads as if it ended up tails, and therefore effectively the setting the apparatus is effectively a free variable. Now, there's an interesting theorem in dynamical systems called the Tarkin's embedding theorem, which I would claim is a kind of counter argument to that sort of argument by Quimsey. And the Tarkin embedding theorem is one that's often used in actual experiment, when you take experimental data and you try to reconstruct the whole attractor.
And what it says is, if you have a dynamical system and you can observe just one variable, and you can observe it for a long enough time, just one component of the state of that dynamical system, then you can reconstruct the whole attractor using what is called a method of delay coordinates. But just one component, and it doesn't matter how energetically irrelevant, how energetically important that component is, even if it was energetically sort of trivial compared to the main energetic parts of the dynamical system. Just knowing that time series of that one component is sufficient to reconstruct the whole of the invariant set. So in a sense, then, that tossing the coin, if you think of it as part of, it's a component, it's a very sort of trivial component, but it's a component of a state on an invariant set, then by observing enough tosses of the coin, you could, in principle, reconstruct the whole invariant set of the universe. That's what the Tarkin's embedding theorem says. And therefore, that toss of that coin is not irrelevant to the rest of the universe. It's just not true to say that the universe couldn't care less whether that coin, the rest of the universe, couldn't care less. It's not true to say that whether the coin ended up heads or tails. So that would be my counter argument to the whimsical, choosing by whimsy sort of argument. The other sort of argument that people, sorry? You'd need an awful lot of tosses of coins, in principle,
Well, I'm not sure how that influences it, but presumably Bell is only thinking that up till now if you toss the coin and then you reset the Stern-Gerlach, then that's a big change.
Yeah, I'm just trying to...
It's coming later.
I'm just backing off and saying you can measure one part by measuring one component of the state of a dynamical system long enough is enough to reconstruct the whole attractor. So you can't kind of take
that. I'm not sure this is relevant, but my point is that if it's relevant, is that you probably have to measure that long past the time that you've already made the choice whether or not.
Oh, yeah. I'm just arguing that the issue is that toss of the coin? Whilst it's by construction, it determines the orientation of the measuring apparatus. Does the rest of the universe care whether or not it ended up heads or tails?
And maybe it doesn't care.
And it does. I'm arguing it does care very much.
I think I'm arguing maybe someday it'll care if you wait long enough, but it doesn't care.
I think it's a timeless question. I don't think you can say it cares tomorrow or next week or something. We're talking about a geometry in state space which has no.
But you're not just saying, are you just saying from that little portion of the history you can tell the whole, you can...
I'm just saying one component of the state.
One coordinate.
Over a sufficiently long period of time is enough to determine or to construct the whole geometry of the invariant set, all the other components. All the other, potentially millions of other components can be determined from the time series of one component. And that's used in, experimental chaotic dynamics a lot. And the theorem which underlies it is called this Tarkin's.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering if this provision for a sufficiently long time is not, to some extent, vitiating your conclusion. That's all. Because it could be a really very long time.
Yeah, well, the more sort of energetically unimportant that variable is, the longer, I guess, the time will be. The second argument, which I make this slightly facetiously, but
nevertheless, I sort of thought I might raise it. I mean, it's this argument, if we restrict free will, are we no better than sort of somehow automata? And here I would just use a kind of version of the Penrose-Lucas argument, which you may or may not like or not like, but it's kind of cute, I think, which just says, well, if I'm a conscious being, I acknowledge as real the world around me. If you like, by definition of, that's what I'm going to define as consciousness, I acknowledge the world around me is real. Now, if I use this invariant set hypothesis, then I'm saying I acknowledge as real something, i.e. a state on the invariant set, which by construction I cannot prove to be real. prove algorithmic to be algorithmically to be real. So I'm just using this point. There's no algorithm that will decide whether a point lies on the invariant set or not. It would take an infinite time to decide whether a point lies on the invariant set or not. A little bit like an event horizon. You know, you can't tell if you're on the event horizon of a black hole. You have to, you know, it could be, you have to wait an infinite amount of time, in principle, to know whether you're on the event horizon of a black hole. So similarly, you can't tell whether you're on the invariant set or not. So, but by this hypothesis, you know, what I'm saying is I'm acknowledging as real something that I cannot prove to be real. So I'm sort of not, therefore I'm not an automaton. So that kind of argument, that counters that argument. All right. So I just want to sort of slowly, what time do I start? I should wrap up. Okay, I haven't got as far as I would have liked. What seems to me kind of interesting about this is that this hypothesis seems to be consistent, you know, with the Koch and Specker theorem, that there are no non-contextual hidden variable theories of quantum physics. The Koch and Specker theorem is derived, you know, what seems to be a rather complicated theorem using Hilbert spaces. The question I have is whether one could somehow work backwards and start with its invariant as an axiom and use it to somehow derive Hilbert spaces in quantum theory. I'm struggling here because I realize I've taken too much time and I'm not going to get through this as well as I might like. So I'm going to sort of say these words rather quickly, but we can talk about it later maybe. Well, what does an invariant set look like? Well, you can't really see it in a sense because they're measure zero and nowhere dense. You can't really compute it. But let's imagine you were an oracle and you could somehow see it. So here's part of state space. And here I'm imagining some set which I've kind of labeled. There are three, red, green, and blue. And I'm going to imagine the green points are off the invariant set. And I've somehow partitioned the invariant set into red and blue. So points belong to either red or blue. Now, I have a theory. Let's imagine I have a theory. This is supposed to be kind of quantum theory, which is blind. It knows nothing about the fine-scale structure of this invariant set. And I want to know how can I represent a point in some, say, neighborhood when I know nothing about this invariant set. Well, one thing I could do is imagine a kind of probability mixture. So I imagine this ket red just describing states which lie on the red part of the invariant set and the ket blue points on the blue part. And this would just be a simple probability mixture. So a point P would be represented by a probability mixture of where alpha and beta were the sort of density of red and blue points on the invariant set in this neighborhood N. Now, actually, this is not itself good enough because this probability mixture assumes that I know whether the point P, it assumes I know the point P lies on the invariant set or not. But if I have a theory blind to the invariant set structure, I don't even know that. So you can imagine, a modification where now I've got three different sort of kets, a red, a blue, and a green. And now the green one, this is again a simple probability mixture, but now the gamma is a coefficient representing points off the invariant set, the green points. Now here we have again a problem where in this representation, when we try and think about experiments, we want to ingest information acquired experimentally into our theory. But by the invariant set hypothesis, it's impossible to perform an experiment on a state which is not on the invariant set. So with this representation, experiments will never be able to use empirical information to determine this gamma, because by definition, experiments are only things which describe the world on the invariant set by hypothesis. So one starts to think about other ways then of representing, you know, in our blind theory of state. So here's it looks like a probability mixture, but now instead of alpha plus beta equals 1, we've got alpha squared plus beta squared equals 1. And now alpha squared and beta squared are the density of red and blue points on the invariant set. So this is now not a simple probability mixture, so it gets over this problem of the fact that we don't know whether a point lies on the invariant set or not. But now we have a problem of not, potentially not enough degrees of freedom. I'm rushing over this a little bit now, but the idea is that we're considering a subsystem, but that subsystem could be orientated in all possible directions in three space relative to the mass of the universe. And a theory which is blind to the fine scale structure of the invariant set must be prepared for the possibility that the subsystem is orientated in any conceivable direction. So that sort of leads me to think about, again, this type of situation where now we use complex coefficients rather than real number coefficients. And so we're getting somewhat closer to quantum theory. Okay. So what I wanted to say really was that in this framework, the notion of superposed states, which are called central to quantum theory, are really just mathematical devices which allow us to describe states of subsystems in a theoretical framework which is blind to this supposed fine-scale structure of the underlying invariant set. And that if one had an oracle theory based on the invariant set hypothesis, one would have no such thing as superposed states. Again, rushing, and apologies for rushing, but just try and get very briefly. So what could an oracle theory look like that was formulated and knew about this invariant set? Well, there's a whole methodology in dynamical systems called symbolic dynamics, where you represent states with respect to some n-element partition of the invariant set. So this is so we could imagine partitioning the invariant set by different colors, and a state on the invariant set would be represented by a sequence of the partition label. And we could equivalently represent that S by breaking this set up into a number of bit strings. And if you have an n-element partition, you'll end up with two log to base 2 of n correlated bit strings. And then the idea is you treat the individual bit strings as primitive subsystems. One very interesting thing is that if you take a bit string, S is a bit string where the elements are, say, red and blue, define an operator which maps a red element into a blue element and a blue element into a red element, and define the negation of the string by applying this phi operator to all the individual elements, so the negation of the negation is the string itself, then you can very easily get a kind of quaternionic type permutation operators. So these operators E1, E2, E3, which sort of permute the elements of the bit string and apply the phi operator to some of them, you can show very quickly are precisely related by quaternionic multiplication. So this is the way I would think of this oracle theory, as which is cognizant of the invariant set. But the quantum theory, which knows nothing about it, has to rely on these superposed states. So superposed states are not really considered to be states of physical reality, necessarily, anyway, in this framework. I think I'm going to skip over this. This is just saying that if you don't have superposed states, you don't need collapses of the wave function. I mean, the measuring apparatus, the role of the measuring apparatus is in defining the structure of the invariant set. I am seeing gravity as playing a key role here. And as I say, most importantly, perhaps, is this notion that black hole dynamics is the thing which provides the reduction in dimension that gives rise to this fractal invariant set in the first place. So black hole dynamics, I would see, as a critical element in generating this invariant set. This is kind of in addition, I think, to the more local effects of gravity, which Roger has spoken, you know, I'm sure you're aware many times about the local effects of the interaction between, say, a subsystem and its measuring apparatus. I'm proposing this as something much more kind of global and in some sense a more fundamental, I think, aspect of the potential role of gravity. So my last slide, last but one slide, is just trying to summarize what I've said. you know, classical physics obviously has been very successful, and the paradigm for classical physics has been differential equations, and so we've got Newton and Maxwell and Einstein and indeed Lorentz, my colleague from my professional work, very successful. And, you know, in some sense, what I guess you guys will try and do is come up with an extension of this paradigm to describe the quantum world. And so you have differential equations or possibly difference equations, and this describes, well, obviously Schrodinger equation, Dirac equation, and I guess string theory and loop quantum gravity are based on this paradigm. What I'm sort of generally asking here is that, yeah, this is clearly the nirvana or the holy grail for fundamental physics. But is this direct route? Is it just saying, look, here, this paradigm has worked very well in classical physics, that the differential equation paradigm has worked very well. Let's apply it to the quantum world. Is this really the right route? And what I'm trying to sort of propose is that instead of going in this direct route, we sort of take a bit of a sidestep and think about these kind of global atemporal fractal geometries as providing a very sort of potentially fundamental aspect of physics from which the sort of more local expressions of dynamical evolution can be derived. And so this is my proposal, that we go in this slightly, often taking detours is good, I think, isn't it? I mean, when you travel around. And rather than going on the motorway. So this is what I'm sort of proposing, take a bit of a detour, and maybe it might lead to some new insights into physics.
If I can go back to this thing about superdeterminism, so it's just a little bit confused. So I just wanted to give first my understanding of what it is that people don't like about that idea, I guess, or the reason. So you said something about what Bell said about it, but to me it's something like the following. So you could say, well, we can toss a coin and that could determine the measurement, or you could say something even crazier, like we roll a dice, and on one we toss a coin, right, and two we make a decision, on three we use the cosmic microwave background radiation,
right,
or something,
yeah,
really crazy.
Sure.
So you can have some,
yeah,
you can have some variable which is sort of very non-locally decided, very thermal in nature, it comes from very microscopic degrees of freedom which don't affect anything else, and so on. And then in one of these super deterministic theories, we're being asked to believe that variable there is correlated in a very specific way to something which is to the outcome on the other side, on the other wing of the experiment. And I suppose the although it's not impossible, then people like Bell say, well, I don't want to work on such theories because I think it would be very hard to predict anything in such a theory, or that would make life very hard if you're thinking that causes of macroscopic events have to be explained in such complicated ways, and how are we ever going to be able to predict things in this kind of theory? More than just free will, it's saying something about how the level of complexity required to be able to understand causation in a theory like that. So how does this theory you mentioned,
Well, as I say, I find it hard to put a finger on precisely what the problem is as you've described it.
Yeah.
Whereas the way Bell describes it is that, and this is why I picked up on this point. He says that these whimsical, whatever it is, tossing a coin, rolling a dice, the outcome of the Swiss lottery, whatever it is, whilst that may be the thing which determines the orientation of the measuring apparatus, it is unimportant for anything else in the universe. So the universe could go on. This is why he says, if you can decide things by whimsy, then effectively these things are free variables, because the rest of the universe doesn't care whether the coin is tossed heads or tails, even though the orientation of the measuring apparatus is. So that's fundamentally the question which I would
Well, that's the presumption I would take issue with in the context of these dynamical systems. And the reason I'm saying that is this example of the Tarkin's theorem, which basically tells you just take any part of the system which may seem, you know, unimportant, but is nevertheless part of the equations. You can determine the whole invariant set from a sufficiently long time series of that.
I don't understand the statement of what that means. You would just have a time series for one dimension, one component, one variable.
One.
And from that, you know everything. You know the dimension of the invariant set.
Absolutely.
With what input, though?
Sorry?
What input do you have to this theorem? You know the dimension, you know the phase space in which the initial.
You have an underlying deterministic dynamical system. That's basically all it is.
So there's some finite dimensional, maybe.
So what people do typically is they
some manifold with a vector space in it, and that determines.
Yeah, and the technique is actually what's called delay coordinates. You sample that time series every, say, 5 seconds or something, and you treat each. You construct a vector, an n-dimensional vector from different sample points. So you construct a phase space, which is actually made from a vector where the points have been sampled every, say, 10 seconds or something, and do that repeatedly, and you can actually observe the whole attractor being built up in phase space. I mean, it's just making the point that In a system like this, you cannot, this assumption that it's a kind of an irrelevant variable is just not.
But then you not only get this attractor, but you know.
You get the dimension, you get the dimension of the attractor, you get the Lyapunov exponents, you get.
And you know which trajectory you have in the attractor, I guess.
You get the geometry of the attractor. You get.
But here you need to know which orbit you have also, I suppose. Because that's the.
No, well, you generate. You can calculate things like, as I say, the dimension of the attractor, the kind of structure of the attractor, whether it's got regimes or, you know, inhomogeneities, the Lyapunov exponents, as I say, of the attractor, all these sort of quantities which characterize the attractor can be generated.
So it's supposed to be a counterexample that I don't quite understand the thing, but yes. So it's supposed to be saying something like, well. Are you saying something like, well, there are systems in which any kind of crazy, like very microscopic variable, which you normally think of as not affecting anything, you can find things like that which will go on to affect macroscopic things in the future anyway. So that's a bit like this system where you have something to do with the Swiss lottery.
I'm just saying it's a geometry. I get away from thinking about time. This is a geometry which kind of exists in state space, and
it's a correlation between events on one axis and events on the other axis of the base space. It's not to be thought of dynamically, is what you're saying,
yes.
In terms of causality, which you're which you have in your space of states.
Right, so
isn't that the important thing? Like,
because if you have a superdeterministic theory, not every correlation is causal. That's the
It's causal in the sense that you could still have a completely Einstein local theory with superdeterminism, like, but it would just be the fact that the outcome on one side was determined by the same thing as the setting on the other side somehow, and that thing would be some very.
Can I just sort of make a slightly different point? I mean, you mentioned this word superdeterminism a number of times, and I kind of think that probably when I hear this word, it's usually meant in a rather pejorative way, because, you know, okay, we can postulate superdeterminism, but why should nature be like that? The superdeterminism just says, well, you know. If you like, this is the only initial condition. The actual initial condition is the only initial condition, and the world evolves from that, and nothing else is possible. Now, you know, that statement is extremely ad hoc. You know, I suppose you can make that assumption, but it's very ad hoc, and it doesn't gel at all with other, you know, basic ideas in physics. And this is why I kind of made the point about invariance, because the basic ideas in physics are based on invariance. I mean, that is, if you had to sort of think of one really fundamental principle that underlies almost everything in physics, it's this notion of invariance or symmetry. And what I'm doing here is introducing, you know, so I'm not kind of postulating superdeterminism as a kind of ad hoc thing which I'm just throwing into the pot. I'm just saying here is something, you know, here is something geometric which arises from dynamical systems, this invariant set. And if we restrict ourselves to this invariant set, we have such a strong constraint on, you know, the ability to perturb things in sort of random ways, that it is sufficient to have all the, if you like, nice things out of superdeterminism, if you like to think of it that way, without having to make any kind of ad hoc, there's no ad hocism in this.
Because that seems more natural in this setting, that you might have these kinds of otherwise microscopic thermal
events
affecting.
That's right. I'm not postulating superdeterminism as a kind of primitive idea. I'm just saying, let's think of these invariant sets as a primitive idea and see where that leads. And this restriction, there's a big restriction on the tahooft, you know, condition, and it's sufficiently big, I think, to we tend to think of phase space as just, you know, Euclidean n-dimensional space, and we're kind of free to kind of go anywhere we like in it. But why should that be?
I'm sympathetic to this general approach. I was thinking about it in a couple of other contexts, but not in the context of a fractal phase space. Mm-hmm. And always when I think about this, I'm wondering where H bar comes in. Mm-hmm. So in here, I mean, it's particularly interesting because you have some real structure, and you have different eyes have different structure, and you might think that H bar is related to that structure.
Yeah, I haven't got that far yet. Okay. That's a great question.
And I think that's probably related to the question of at what point does the phase space look classical? So at what point does it look like objects become?
Yeah, well, an interesting, by the way, an interesting, that's a good question. I mean, an interesting thing is that, there are things like the central limit theorem. I mean, if you take a trajectory and just average stuff, you know, average the state around a sufficiently long portion of a trajectory, and then compute the probability density function of that averaged state, you'll just get a multi-dimensional, this will blur, you know, be like a lump of jelly, go into a multi-dimensional Gaussian. As soon as you have any kind of continuous probability distribution, all of this stuff is no longer relevant. And then you have something looking much more like classical theory. So, yeah, where does H-bar come in? It's got to have something, the way I kind of think about it, but I haven't quite got my head around it, is it something to do with how long does this structure survive a kind of a running time average or something along the trajectory? Maybe something like that. Because at some stage, you're going to smear things out sufficiently that these counterfactual perturbations will still lie. If you've got it, once you've gone to a Gaussian, then you can perturb things as much as you like, and they'll still lie in the probability distribution. But, you know, I can't really answer that properly yet.
Maybe we should leave it there and get dinner outside.
Yeah.